There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Larry Emder here, and today I'm flying solo for the Morning Show podcast while Kylie chases down the Easter Bunny and the last of those hot cross buns. But a big episode for you on the way. Home Improvement's Richard Kahn, or as you may remember him, Al Borland, tells us about teaming up with Tim Allen for a new show. Jules Sebastian, the wonderful Jules Sebastian, is on to tell us about her new book and share some stories about her early days with Guy. And from Erinsborough to America, Alan Dale on making it big in the States. But we begin with one of the most iconic and powerful voices in music. The pandemic may have stopped Melissa Etheridge from performing on stage, but it didn't stop her from streaming live music out of her garage.
Melissa Etheridge is many things: cancer survivor, gay rights activist, mother and partner, but the role we love her for most, rock star.
For sure, with her smoky vocals and powerhouse musical talents, the singer-songwriter has enjoyed 30 plus years of success, and she's got the awards to prove it. Melissa Etheridge joins us live from LA. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
We've got to talk through these song titles. Bring Me Some Water, Come to My Window. These are very demanding song titles. Was this sort of the rock star persona coming through? Do it and do it now.
Well, you know, I've always loved the songs that you got to go get it. And that's rock and roll, you know, when you say, I need this, I want this, I got to have this. So I've always done that.
Well, we rattled off some of your many successes, Grammys and Oscar. I mean, do you have a favorite achievement within the industry?
Oh, you know, I think ultimately it's the longevity. It's being able to still go perform live and have audiences come out to see me. That's the best. The awards are sweet and nice and fun, and that's a very heavy Oscar, and it's always, you know, it's cool. But really, just being able to still make music, to record music and perform music, that's the best part of everything right now.
We love this Walk of Fame moment too, there with your guitar. In 2005, you performed at the Grammys while in treatment for cancer. You've been able to grasp the reality of that moment, what it meant to so many people?
For the last 17 years now, a month doesn't go by that someone doesn't mention that.
Yeah,
it was really an important thing to me, and that scream was probably the best medicine of my whole cancer treatment. So, it was a special time, and I'm glad I was able to help people, and it changed my life in where I really realized health is absolutely the most important thing.
And how is your health, Melissa?
My health is very good. I'm totally 17 years cancer-free. Learning how stress is a killer, and you really gotta put yourself first. And I speak of that all the time in concert, and now I do these the streaming shows 5 days a week on something called Etheridge TV. You can go to etheridgetv.com and subscribe. But in those shows, I'm always just speaking about how it's so important for us to put ourselves first.
Yeah. Tell us more about Etheridge TV. What are we going to find when we log on?
Well, it was born because, with this global pandemic, pretty much the last thing that's going to come back is live performances. I understand that. So I wanted to still connect with my fans. And so my wife and I, in our garage, we built a streaming studio. And we've got about seven cameras, and it's all hooked up. And I do three concerts a week, and then two kind of chat shows. One of them shows old videos, old bootlegs and stuff. And it's just, if you're missing live music and connection. Come join us. It's melissaethridge.com, or actually ethridgetv.com, and you can join us. We've got a lot of Aussies that get up in the morning and see it. It's on at 3 o'clock here, so that's about right now. So you can also watch it. You can also watch it on demand.
Right. So morning time in Australia. I guess for the fans, what they're loving is they're getting to see you in a really personal space. And I guess that allows you to open up maybe. And you share a lot with your fans. If we could just talk about, mate, the passing of your son in early last year.
I told my fans that they're getting used to seeing me up close, you know, like front row. So they're going to have to get used to that. But we've gone on a year now. It's been a year of streaming, and we learned a lot. And it's just it's a way that I can keep connected. We talk about the personal stuff. We talk about things that are important, community. We laugh, a lot of laughing, a lot of entertainment. I really think music is important, and it's a very healing thing. And so I try to bring that not only just to myself, but also my fans.
Okay. Now, we know you have a special relationship with Australia, touring here over the years many times, right? Adelaide was one of the first markets to put your music on high rotation. What a wonderful piece. I mean, we're proud to, that makes you nearly one of us. We've been a really big part of this story.
I love that. Adelaide, I remember the little radio station in Adelaide where it grew, and it was one of the first places in the whole wide world that really caught on to my first album. I remember my manager saying, you're doing very well in Australia. And I went, Australia? Because that was so far away, you know, for me at the time. So I always loved going down there, and I love how precious that first album is. And I love being a classic rocker now down there for you guys.
A classic rocker, I love it. Always, 30 years since publicly identifying as a lesbian. Do you ever reflect on how your bravery, I guess you could call it bravery, paved the way for many to follow, Melissa?
Oh, well, you know, I did it because I couldn't live a life in the shadows like that. That didn't make sense. I wanted to be myself. My songs were very personal. And since then, I mean, it's been over 25 years now. It's been a long, almost 30 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, since then, I've never, ever regretted it. And it certainly has been something that people say has inspired them. And that means a lot to me. That means a whole lot to me.
Well, lovely to talk to you. And despite the fact that 3 minutes ago you told the morning show viewers to stop watching morning TV and watch Etheridge TV at about this time of the day, we still love chatting to you. Thank you so much. Great chat.
All right. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Melissa.
Great fun.
Great to see you. Well, Jules Sebastian is the person you just want to have a couple with. 6 years ago, she started the YouTube sensation Tea with Jules, sharing open and honest stories with the likes of Kate Ritchie, Samantha Jade, and our very own Laz.
Now, fast forward to today, the mum of two is embracing a new role as an author, turning her hit online series into a book and spilling the tea on her life in the spotlight.
And Jules Sebastian joins us live. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, guys.
In the book, you share some lessons that you've learned from celeb guests. Who's given you the most surprising answer?
Well, you know what? I wrote it. There's 12 chapters in the book, and each chapter is a life experience, essentially. So we're talking about identity and comparison and kindness and passion and purpose and kind of all the big things you go through in life. And there's a chapter in there about fear. And I remember when I was first starting Tea with Jules, and there were so many people I admired and I wanted to ask onto the show. And Lisa Messenger was one of those people who I just, from afar, I didn't know her, never met her. And I was actually very fearful about asking her to come on because I thought she would say no, she'd be too busy, and then I'd be embarrassed and all the rest of it. Anyway, she said yes, she came on the show, and I conquered my fear of asking her, and we sat down for a tea. And then I actually asked her, do you get afraid of things? Like, are you fearful of things? Mm. And what surprised me was she said yes, because I thought people like that aren't afraid of anything, and they can just do everything and they don't feel afraid of anything they're trying. So I think that's been one of the things, a big lesson I've learned, that I do most things afraid all the time, like right now. I'm afraid. Yeah, yeah. I wrote a book. I've just put a book out into the world. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, right.
And I think most people have a fear of, you know, whatever they're doing and trying. Yeah.
You do this thing. I've been on that show. And yes. You do this thing where you speak very quietly and you smile a lot. And next minute you're trapped. And you're saying things as a guest that you would never, ever say, because they're not even questions. It's just this fabulous conversation. You have this beautiful way of extracting information. You do this deep diving into a lot of personal experiences for the book. What was the most difficult chapter for you to write, do you think?
I think probably there's a chapter on grief, and I lost my brother 5 days after we got married. So we were on our honeymoon and got that tragic phone call that my brother had passed away, taken his own life, and it was just sideswiping and shocking and awful. And I never really talked about that too much in the public eye before. Mm. And so I wrote a chapter on grief, and you don't have to experience grief just because you've lost somebody. You can experience grief in all sorts of ways. And I think it's just something that you, when you lose something that you love and you lose something that you want, I think you go through that process of grief and those stages and phases. But also, I don't think it ever really ends. And so that was kind of a hard chapter to wrap up, because I was like, mm-hmm. Well, get to the end of this chapter and you're like, well, you never actually reach the end of grief. You always have a somebody-shaped hole in your heart or something that you will miss. But I think if you pay honour to that, I think that's actually quite beautiful. So that was a tough one to write. That took me quite a while to get through.
Right. Beautiful words. You also share how Guy first asked you out. Apparently it involves a bus stop and a very awkward conversation.
Yes, I know. So the official moment when we became boyfriend and girlfriend, we were friends for about a year before we actually got romantic about it. Mm. And we had that awkward conversation of like, are we more than friends now? What is this feeling we're having? And we're out for kind of supper after church, I think, with a bunch of our friends. And he was like, I need to get some money out at the ATM. Can you come with me? So we go to the ATM and he gets some cash out. I think he just needed some alone time with me to like build up the courage. Mm-hmm. And then we sat at an empty bus stop and he was like, so I like you. And I was like, I like you.
Did you see how much cash he took out?
I made him pay for my
dinner.
And
this all happened after church. That makes it beautiful.
It was a very romantic situation.
Now, you mentioned before that you became close with Guy through singing, right? So could we get you two together on a microphone, on a stage, somewhere, sometime, somehow?
I'm not going to promise you that, but maybe.
And maybe promises, okay.
Maybe after two cocktails.
Oh, yes. Oh, you
your
do cocktail. Love a cocktail.
Your
cocktail. Oh, my God, your cocktails are legendary. The boys.
Yes.
Two gorgeous young boys.
Yes.
Who's the fun parent, you or Guy?
Oh, well, I feel like I'm the non-fun one. I'm the enforcer of all the things. So, like, get up, get dressed, this, you know, we're going here, this is run on time, the scheduler, the enforcer. I would say Guy, I'd give the Guy the fun parent award for sure. He's a good time. He's always, like, you know, throwing them around and playing, taking them to sport and...
But you make the good
everything.
Cocktail, so the other parents prefer to hang out with
That's
you
exactly
anyway.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Congratulations on Tea and Honesty. It's a beautiful book. Tea with Jules is a beautiful concept, and you're a wonderful guest. Thanks for coming in.
The new book is called Tea and Honesty. It's by Jules Sebastian. It's just a beautiful book. It's a chat, and it is out now.
Does everyone know what time it is?
It's Jewel time!
We've been rehearsing that for 3 weeks. It
was
the show.
Good.
You were good.
It's not going to get much better than that.
No, that was pretty good. Thank you, everybody. It was a show within a show, and they were both so good. Award-winning sitcom Home Improvement had an 8-season run, and we were there for every laugh-out-loud moment and DIY disaster. It was great.
A long accident-prone Tim the Toolman Taylor was his trusty assistant Al Borland, played by actor Richard Khan. The flannel shirt-wearing handyman may have been the butt of Tim's jokes, but he had some of the best one-liners.
Al, what's the first thing you do when you get up?
I say to myself, oh boy, another wonderful day of working side-by-side with Tim.
What's the second thing you do, Al?
I consider calling in sick.
Like the morning show.
Exactly. Now the famous duo are back together. This is very exciting, having reunited for a new reality series. So does this mean we'll see the return of one of Al's most famous catchphrases?
I don't think so, Tim.
Well, we think so. Richard Khan joins us live from LA. Welcome to the morning show. 30 years since Home Improvement hit the air. Where did that time go?
Oh, my gosh. It's been a long, long time, hasn't it?
Amazing. Where'd the time go?
Yeah, I know. Where did the time go? But I look back at that and I just laugh. I can now watch the show without worrying about stuff that happened or didn't happen or got left out. It's really kind of wonderful to be able to watch it without a memory.
Well, we know what you've been doing since, reading John Grisham novels and cleaning that beautiful fish tank. But your character, Al Borland, was loyal and sensitive and clearly more skilled than Tim. This was never a question. But you almost didn't have the role at all yet.
No. Oh, gosh. The wonderful thing is I took a job for $100 a week. And I met the producers like 4 or 5 years before I got that job. And you know what? Just networking, just meeting people and staying friends really helped me get the job.
And did the pay ever go up or?
Did the pay?
Yeah.
You know, the stock market has done really wonderful over the last 20 years.
So you and Tim Allen have worked together on Home Improvement. You made an appearance on his other sitcom, Last Man Standing, and now you're back together again for, it's a show called Assembly Required.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, I know. It's really fun. And this time, it's interesting because we don't have writers. It's like whatever comes out of our mouth is what we're writing, you know, basically. So Tim was a little nervous about that. I had done a game show. I had done Family Feud for a few years, so I was kind of, ready for that. But it was like picking up from old times. It was a lot of fun. And I can't believe some of the stuff they left in. You know, stuff that I just, you know, we would say not knowing that they would keep it in.
So this new show, it's obviously testament to the fact that A, 3 decades on, fans still love seeing you on the screen. B, you and Tim are still great mates. That's important. And C, people everywhere, particularly through the pandemic, right, fell in love with DIY. Everyone had these little home improvements to do.
Well, you know, you're sitting around your house and you're looking at stuff that you've let go for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. You go, that I should take care of that. Or see, you're sitting in your backyard. You're right. I've done a lot of things around my house that I had put off for years.
Speaking of the pandemic, is it true, Richard, you did actually suffer COVID?
You know, I don't know if I can call it suffering. I had a little bit of a cough and I looked at my wife and I went, oh no, I have COVID. And we laughed about it. And then like maybe 5 hours later, I had a cookie and I immediately put my mask on and went back to talk to my wife. And she goes, what do you got your mask on? I says, I can't taste the cookie.
Oh.
So the next day I went in and I got tested and I tested positive, but nobody around me caught it. My wife didn't catch it. People I was around before, I don't know how I got it or what, but I just stayed away from people for like 14 days.
Mm. Okay. So your wife appeared actually in some episodes of Home Improvement as Jill Taylor's sister. She's an actress and a singer, of course, and your son is in showbiz. It's running pretty good in that family of yours there.
Well, it's a big difference between when I was getting into the business and now when my son Cooper's getting into the business. It's a lot about social media. I mean, I'm sure you guys know this because you have to be on top of that. And what I still try to instill in him is that, it does help to have a lot of likes and a lot of people, you know, paying attention to you online. But, you know, when you get the job, you still have to be good. You still have to know what to do.
Yeah,
you
still
and that's important.
Still got to deliver. Richard, you mentioned Family Feud, that you hosted that in the early 2000s. Larry, my co-host here, set to return to his game show roots. He's about to start hosting a program called The Chase. So any advice for him?
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know. I don't know the parameters of what The Chase is, but what was great about Family Feud was you had people that were under pressure to say answers, and so stuff would come out of their mouth. And, you know, all the comedy is written right there, as long as you take advantage of it. You know, so it was like improv theater, basically. Yeah. And I enjoyed it to the limits. I loved doing that show. Yeah,
that sounds more like The Morning Show than The Chase. But listen, lovely to talk to you this morning. I love that show so much. It was a real treat. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks,
I hope that Assembly Required is well received in Australia.
For sure. Huge fan base for you guys out here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Richard. Well, like so many great New Zealand actors, we've claimed this next guy as our own too. With a stint on The Young Doctors and playing a pivotal role on Ramsay Street, Alan Dale firmly cemented his place in Australian TV history.
But it wasn't long before Hollywood came a-calling and the Kiwi was catapulted into a major star with unforgettable performances in The O.C., Ugly Betty, and even the fabulous Entourage.
With more than four decades of phenomenal film and small screen credits, Alan Dale's latest character is reimagining a classic. And it's in Atlanta, Georgia, where we find Alan Dale this morning. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, you two. Hi. Good
morning.
You're over there filming the modern remake of Dynasty, or Dynasty, as they call it.
I've got used to saying Dynasty now, you know. I remember when the first one was around, we always had trouble saying Dynasty, but I've lived here for a while, so I'm sort of used to it.
What's it been like rebooting this 80s soap opera, the classic?
Well, it was interesting. Actually, we have a lot of fun. I hadn't really realised that it was quite sort of comedic, really, and we've sort of played that up quite a lot, really. So, it's been really good fun.
And who are you playing, Alan?
I play the butler. Because I've got a Kiwi accent or a Kiwi Australian accent that sort of sounds like an English accent, so I reckon I make a good butler.
The keeper of all the secrets.
Yes, that too.
Now, it's been 15 years since Ugly Betty first aired on the small screen. There are a lot of sort of catty characters in the show. What was it like behind the scenes of that one?
Oh, interesting. It was really good fun. It was such an ensemble, and really, we everyone got on really well. That's really, I think, really important if you want to play those sort of aggressive sort of, you know, characters and things. You got to get on with everybody so that nobody takes it too personally.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk Entourage. It's such a fabulous show. You featured in the TV series of Entourage and then also in the film. What was that like? How do you sort of rate that in your career?
It's interesting. It's high up there in terms of what I respected, you know, the things I've done that I respect a lot. I was a recurring character more, though. So, you know, I'd walk in there. I didn't really talk to many people. I just walk in there, abuse people and walk out, really.
You played a president, a judge, a doctor, a king. Which was the best one? Because I reckon being a president would be kind of cool.
You know, they're all really good fun and they're a lot less work than actually being any of those things, you know?
Yes, the university requirement is far
being
less.
A doctor, for example. Yeah.
Fantastic. You married Miss Australia 1986. That was journalist and broadcaster Tracy Dale.
Indeed.
Does she ever join you overseas on these big projects?
Mostly she does, but in the last few years, because we've had a couple of kids together, they've been going through their, you know, final high school and early college stuff, and so she's had to stay home during the last few years, which has been hard. But, you know, FaceTime and Zoom and things makes it a lot easier now and things. But no, we're still very happy together, and she's about to. With the COVID problem, our dog can't fly, so we're going to have to drive across America with our dog so that she can come and join me for the rest of the season.
Hey, Alan, are people recognising you in the street? You've been on so many different roles, on so many different shows. Are people stopping in the street?
You know, no. And I like that. I like it just like you. Yeah, it's great.
So you've been in showbiz for 43 years. What are the plans ahead?
You know, it's an interesting thing because, of course, the older you get, the more people ask you, are you going to retire? And my feeling is no, because I did this for nothing. I used to be an amateur dramatic person back in the 60s and early 70s. And so, you know, if I stopped doing it for money, then I'd go off and I'd do it for nothing. It's not the point, really.
Is there one great role you really want to play? One great...
Well, you know, there's one I'm terrified by that I would, you know, I couldn't say no to. That'd be King Lear.
Yes.
All right.
I can see you in that.
You know, it's such a huge role. Yeah. You know, but I'd love to do that. But, you know, I think that's what I'd like to do now is for the rest of, you know, my time here, I'd like to sort of just go places that are interesting and have fun and sort of, you know, just do little bits and pieces here and there.
Sounds perfect. So great to catch up with you, Alan, and best of luck shooting Dynasty over there in Atlanta. Nice to
Dynasty.
Talk to you.
Dynasty, I think, is what you're
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Alan. Great Thanks, to Barry. Chat. I spy with my little eye something beginning with CIA. It's one of the most powerful intelligence agencies in the world and worthy of a better intro than that. It's full of intrigue, espionage and deception. And who better to explain the tactics and gadgets than this real-life spy?
John Amendez served as a technical operations officer and the agency's chief of disguise, working in hostile situations in some of the most dangerous places with expertise in clandestine photography and identity transformation. Wow. Reporting for duty live from Washington, D.C. is Jonna Mendez, or is it? Hello, Jonna.
Good morning.
You were working at a bank in Europe. You became a secretary for the CIA and then quickly moved into clandestine photography. So take us through your responsibilities for the role. What did you actually do?
Well, I was an amateur photographer in my early days. And when I was working as a secretary at CIA, I was going to leave. I was bored. And they offered me an opportunity to take some very unique training courses that we only give to our operations officers. So I took the courses and sort of gently elbowed my way into a new professional status of a technical operations officer specializing in clandestine photography. And it was amazing. I traveled the world teaching foreign agents how to collect the information we needed with non-commercial cameras, with proprietary cameras. Now that's a Minox. You could go out to a store back then and buy it. And it was used as a spy camera. I used my Minox when I skied because I fell a lot and I wasn't going to hurt it or me. Our cameras got even smaller. Our cameras were the backbone of a lot of our operations during the Cold War. This is more typical. This is one of our cameras inside of a pen.
Okay.
You can see the little film cartridge, and there's film in the cartridge. Someone had to load that film. That cartridge is on the left, right there.
Wow, wow. You've got some amazing stories to tell. During the Cold War, you communicated with other agents using dead rats. Is that right? Can you explain that?
Well, dead rats was one thing that we used. It was part of a larger category called concealment devices. There were places in the world, particular cities in the world, where it was too dangerous for us to meet face-to-face with our foreign agent. It was also, more importantly, it was dangerous for the foreign agent, because if we were caught, they'd just tell us to leave. If the agent was caught, in a lot of countries, he'd be killed, he'd be executed. So we used rats as a universal idea. No one's gonna touch that rat, a dead rat, except the person who is specifically looking for it in that particular place. But it might be a fake brick. It could be a smashed Coke can. It could be a greasy construction glove which had material inside of it. We used all kinds of concealment devices.
And as chief of disguise, you also help the spies themselves hide their identities. What's involved in that? Where do you start when changing the way someone looks? Because if it's not done well, you can pick that a mile off.
Well, you have to sit down and figure out what they need, where they're going, how long they're going to wear it, what the conditions are there. And then you start taking the person apart. And it's not just their face. It's the whole person. It might be they have such a unique walk that you need to change their walk. It might be someone who used their hands so much that you need to give them something to hold on to, maybe a pipe, cigarette. But basically, top down, we'd say if their hair was short, we wanted it longer. If it was blonde, we wanted it darker. If they had a mustache, we'd tell them to shave it. If they didn't, we'd give them one. Glasses or no glasses. We could do dental facades. We could change their teeth. Were they married? We have them take off their wedding ring. It just went endlessly on. We'd reverse everything about them that we could.
Top to bottom. Wow. The Mission Impossible movies feature a whole lot of masks. Disguises, which many may think is sort of this Hollywood exaggeration, but you actually helped develop something called the 5-second mask. What's that?
It was 10 years of R&D is what it was. The 5-second mask was something that you could pull into a parking lot, pick up the mask in the dark, put it on, adjust it, register it really, get out of your car, and you knew that you had a total disguise on with just one piece of equipment. It was fantastic. It was easy on, it was quick off, It had to crumple down so you could put it under your arm as you walked down the street. Tom Cruise's masks were wonderful to look at, but a lot of trick photography.
Yeah.
When Tom came out of his disguise, he looked terrible. We had to look normal when we came out of ours.
Yeah,
so
right.
You've spoken about the Jason Bourne movies and what they got wrong. What would you have changed with someone on the ground experience?
I would change everything about the Jason Bourne movie. My son loves them, so I can't be too vocal about it. It is everyone's wish that that's what espionage was like. Moments of excitement, safety deposit boxes full of guns and a multitude of passports and currency from every country. None of that is true, but it's so fun to watch.
Yeah. Okay.
My problem with Jason Bourne is it just so rubs me the wrong way. Those passports, they were like gold just to make one that was actually going to get you through immigration.
Yeah.
And he's dead with a handful. So it just irritated me to watch Jason Bourne.
Okay. We love the movie still, right? Yeah. You got a new book called The Moscow Rules. How did you manage to get the CIA to agree to share their secrets for you with the book?
It's in our paperwork. When we're hired, you sign an authorization that they can review everything that you've ever written. I've written another book. It was my pandemic project. I thought might as well I could learn French or I could write another book. And it's at the CIA right now undergoing review. So all of these books have been reviewed and the CIA has agreed that what's in the books is no longer classified.
Wow.
And when I talk like to you, as long as I stick to what's in the books, and I've got four books, I've got a lot of information, I'm good.
You're good. Okay. Well, it's been a delight to talk to you today, Jonna. Yeah. And we saw the book Argo there. That, of course, was about your late husband, Tony Mendez, who Ben Affleck.
That was Ben Affleck trying to be as good-looking as my husband.
Love it. It's a terrific book and, of course, movie. Thank you so much, Jonna. Fascinating stuff.
Good to talk to you.
Amazing stuff. I just feel like the CIA might be watching us now.
There's a dead rat in the corner, so look out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, he is the Gold Logie-winning larrikin that we know and love, starring in hit series like The Secret Life of Us and Molly. But for the past few years, Samuel Johnson's main focus has been working tirelessly for his charity, Love Your Sister. He's gone above and beyond for cancer research, raising over $13 million.
Now, with Mother's Day a little over a month away, the best-selling author has turned his attention to celebrating motherhood with some help from his famous pals. Samuel Johnson joins us live. Welcome back, mate. Lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me.
What
I really appreciate
project.
It.
Now, before we chat to you about the book, you're an actor, author, philanthropist, Order of Australia recipient, but we see on socials now that you're a tennis champ as well.
No. I've got a bit of tennis pedigree. My dad was a player. He won the championship in my hometown a few times.
Is that right?
And
I
was lucky enough.
The Daylesford Lawn Tennis Club Championship.
Yes, I snared my second title on the weekend. I was really, really lucky to get a win over Colin there. My dad won it six times. I've now won it twice. Of course, I'm trying to best him.
Of course you are.
Yes, you keep going until you get it seven times. So we've read your previous books. You've done Dear Dad, and you also did Dear Santa.
Yeah.
So this comes your third instalment. It's called Dear Mum. So take us through the inspiration for this one, Samuel.
Well, it's a celebration of mums. As co-founder of Love Your Sister, I represent about 700,000 women and mums in the breast cancer space.
Mm.
I'm very passionate about keeping our mums well. And I really wanted to put together a fitting tribute, an homage, a celebration of all things mums. So I got asked over 90 Australian notables to contribute letters to their mums for publication so that I can use the proceeds to fund cancer research.
Beautiful.
It's a terrific project. The book is filled with really heartwarming letters from notable Aussies, and you write a touching tribute to your mum, who you lost at just 3 years old. Did you find across the letters and as you were collecting them, it was actually some common themes that held them all together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, mums, it's a universal theme. I mean, what I didn't anticipate was just how cathartic an experience it would be for everybody, including me. I mean, until you write it down, you don't quite know how you feel. And sometimes we opened up cans of worms and pulled a few skeletons out of closets as well. It's not just a fluffy Hallmark kind of tribute to mums. It's also an intricate look at the complex relationships that we share with our mums, and some of our contributors have decided to clear the air with their mums. Some of them are being very refreshing and honest. Mm. Not all of them are fairy floss.
Oh, do you have a favourite letter from the book?
Well, of course, Larry's letter is one of my favourites, but so too is Guy Pearce's. He writes a very touching letter to his mum with dementia. Just one sentence I'll read if I can. Yeah. He writes, I think of all the times you told me you never wanted to end up a bloody vegetable. How if it ever came to that, I had your permission to knock you on the head. Instead, I just let you sit in your nursing home like a piece of broccoli simmering away on a stove longer than it should. And to think I had the chance to pull the plug once. A really sharp, insightful and very heartbreaking letter about a son dealing with his mother who's got dementia.
That's heartbreaking.
Larry's, thank you for contributing, Larry.
No, mate, pleasure.
You say of your mum, yes, you are awesome, but so is a nice holiday, so that word doesn't work. Yes, you're amazing, but so is a great dinner, so that word isn't enough either. Yes, you're incredible, but then so was the first moon landing, and you're a trillion times more impressive than that. Larry uses his letter to try and find the words to explain the love for his mum.
For his beautiful mum,
which is impossible.
And your letter is amongst the most charming in this assembly. I'm really grateful that you wrote for it. And also, Sam Mac. Sam Macronym
this is about his mum Loretta.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He decided that he would accord his mum Loretta with her own three-letter acronym TMH for the mum hug. And his letter's quite a delight as well. There's so many favourites in there.
So how does this help your cause?
All proceeds go to Cancer Vanquishment.
Beautiful.
Simple. I mean, I didn't want to just celebrate mums. I wanted to help knock cancer on the head as well.
Yeah.
So as always, everyone's contributed for free. We just cover the costs of the book and the rest goes to Cancer Vanquishment. It's not just important for us to celebrate mums, but also to make sure that we protect them from cancer.
Oh, see, my mum's watching. That's the first time she would have heard the contributed for free. She was expecting royalties from this, I'm sure. Now, leading up to Mother's Day, you're
face the action. Face us shouting at the screen. Like, that's all right.
That's all right. You told me 25.
Don't worry, I've got your face.
But it was her birthday on Sunday, and she'd be thrilled to hear you read that as well.
And it was her birthday on Sunday. Now Larry's getting the book for free to give to her.
Yes, yes.
But I'll sign it. It's fine.
Thank you, Sam. Lovely to see you. It's a beautiful book.
Really beautiful.
Thank you.
Don't forget you can pick up your copy of Dear Mum by Samuel Johnson. It is out now.
Hope you like your birthday present, Mum.
Well, out of the COVID pandemic, the JobKeeper scheme offered support to those in need, keeping businesses afloat and people employed. But with that support ending yesterday, many Australians are concerned about their financial future.
Yeah, so what help is still available for those struggling and how can we access those much-needed funds?
Yeah, well, for more information, we're joined live by the General Manager of Services Australia, Hank Jongen. Great to see you again, Hank. So JobKeeper ending, that's a big concern for a lot of people. What should people do if they're worried about their finances?
Look, we understand a lot of people are very worried and concerned right now. Treasury estimates tell us that roughly about 100,000 to 150,000 people will be transitioning across to job seeker payment. And my message is claim now and claim online. What I really want to emphasise is that there's no need for people to come into our offices or to call us. The best and easiest way to lodge an application for either JobSeeker or youth allowance if you're under 22 and find yourself unemployed, is to lodge an application now and do it online. The process is very simple and straightforward. You go through MyGov and you'll find a button once you're in MyGov that says government support for coronavirus, and you simply follow the prompts.
All right, Hank, take us through who can apply for JobSeeker. Now, is it only people who find themselves without a job, or, for example, if your boss can only afford to keep you 2 or 3 days a week, is there support available for that scenario?
Look, it really depends on the level of income that you're receiving from your boss. But of course, there's two payments available. JobSeeker is for people aged 22 and over, and youth allowances for those under age 22. It really just depends on the amount of income that you receive. The government has increased the threshold of how much you can earn before it affects your payment. Now, here's the tip. To find out what you're likely to be eligible for, go to servicesaustralia.gov.au. Services Australia is one word. Once you're in there, search for need a payment. Need a payment. If you search for that, it will lead you to a payment guide, which will give you an indication as to what you're likely to be eligible for and set you on the pathway of lodging an application. And my advice really is do it online. It's the simplest way. It's also contact-free because, of course, over the past 12 months, we've had to look for contact-free solutions.
Yeah. And I think, Hank, too, the difference here will be with JobKeeper, it didn't really matter what your household earned. If you'd had a job, you were still going to get JobKeeper. We're going to find a lot of people who are married or in de facto relationships. The household income affects whether you get JobSeeker, doesn't it? So I think that's where we're going to find the transition here for a lot of people, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Partner income is taken into account. But again, the government has increased the limits on partner income. Look, I'm not going to go through numbers here because that will, you know, if I mention a number, it's just people will then lock that in their memory. It really just depends on whether you're a couple or single, whether you have children. The other thing to bear in mind is if you're paying rent, you may also be eligible for rent assistance. But if you're not sure, go to servicesaustralia.gov.au. If you know what you need to apply for, go to my.gov.au.
Beautiful.
Gee, for so many people, it's just been one thing after another, hasn't it, recently? Those floods have been tragic parts for our East Coast. But Centrelink is able to supply support payments from the government for those in need. And let's start with the Australian Government Disaster Recovery Payment. What's in it and how much are people entitled to, Hank?
Okay. Well, look, we've mobilised staff from across, not only across the organisation, but also across the public service to deal with this demand, combined with JobSeeker payment. Let me just assure you, we are geared for that. Okay, disaster recovery payment is $1,000 per adult and $400 per child for those whose property has been affected by the floods, severely affected by the floods. By that, we usually mean that water's inundated, sewerage may have overflowed, those sorts of issues make you eligible. Also, if you've been injured, then you could also be eligible.
Okay, as we head into Easter, our final question, Hank, does Easter change the day that people get paid with their payments?
Look, in some instances, obviously we're closed on Good Friday and Easter Monday, which means that in some instances people have had to provide us with information a day or two early. The other thing is some people will be paid a day or two early. It's important to remember this is not an extra payment, it's an early payment.
Okay.
And what we're saying to people is, you know, you therefore need to budget for the next normal cycle of your payment.
All right, Hank, always good to talk to you and work through all of that. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Well, between JobKeeper ending this week and real estate prices skyrocketing, many Australians are finding their financial health one of the hardest roads to navigate.
Very turbulent, isn't it? So for more on how to make the most of your money, we're joined by Channel 7 finance editor Gemma Acton. Hey, Gemma, nice to see you. So much to unpack here. We're going to start with JobKeeper. Up to 150,000 Aussie jobs could be at risk now the support has ended. Are we ready for that? Can we handle that impact?
Well, our economy is actually in terrific shape, particularly when you compare to what people thought it was going to be like if we go back as recently as last October when we had the last budget update. The unemployment rate's fallen a lot more quickly than we expected. The deficit's going to be a lot lower than we feared. The government's bringing in a lot more in the way of taxes. So we're actually in pretty good shape. And while the labour market recovery has been so strong, the momentum, it'll probably take a little bit of a dip now, but people don't think this is going to throw it completely off course. Now, that is not to detract from the 150,000 households that will be in trouble now and have lost that source of income.
If you're in a Brisbane cafe at the moment or some Brisbane accommodation, you know, you're kind of feeling that you're going, no, not again, I don't think I can take another hit.
Absolutely.
So how's that affecting things, Brisbane lockdown?
The timing is absolutely horrible. JobKeeper finishes on Sunday. On tomorrow, we're supposed to be getting those half-price flights, which are very much directed at supporting Queensland tourist areas. And who's going to be buying a flight to Queensland right now, half-price or not? So this is a real punch in the guts for anybody up in Queensland. They're estimating the lockdown could cost around $2 billion. And that's just in immediate costs. But if we think about what that does to our confidence going forward and booking and wanting to go up there, it's going to have obviously much more costs.
Now, on the other hand, Australian real estate prices. This is crazy stuff.
Yes.
Set to see the sharpest rise possibly since the 80s. Many people already locked out of the market. What happens now? Is it needs to be a circuit breaker of some sort, I suppose.
Well, there are two organisations that are really responsible for looking at house prices. One is the prudential regulator, APRA, and they've said, look, we're not too worried because we are supposed to worry about stability to make sure that people are taking on debt they can afford, and we think they are. And then the Reserve Bank is saying, look, we're not too worried. We think it's more important to keep interest rates low to support the jobs recovery than to increase them to bring house prices down. So in sum, both the authorities looking at house prices saying, look, we're not going to move and do anything right now. That's a different picture, though. If you're a buyer who wants to get into the market, you're one of those dozens and dozens of people who are turning up to auctions every weekend, those people who are bidding well over the asking price, affordability is getting worse again.
Gemma, can I ask, where's the money coming from?
Well, it's because interest rates are so low.
People are paying like $2 million over reserves.
And it's a great question. The money is mostly from Australians. International investors are far down than they have been on levels in the past. But money's so cheap to borrow. So we're borrowing far more than we did in the past because interest rates are so low. But the Reserve Bank doesn't think it's time to move them up.
Catastrophic if those numbers bounce back up a little bit. All right, we're also seeing a rise in people renting in the big cities, but buying in the regions is a good investment too. This is a good thing. People are going, I don't have to live in the city anymore and pay those prices. I can live anywhere and work remotely now.
Yeah, well, it's smart. Look, if you can afford in the regions to buy there and you want to do that, then that works. You know, I think if people want to get into the housing ladder, people are being a bit more imaginative now in terms of where they buy. Some people have to still work in the city, but they're thinking of buying elsewhere, renting that out, and then renting in the city. So I think it's good that people are being more imaginative about how they get onto the housing ladder.
I can tell you who doesn't think it's good, though. The people living in the country. I've got friends living in the country and they're going, oh, my God, people from the city are coming and buying up all our houses for investments and we can't afford to buy them. So people who actually live in those country
towns. We've seen that particularly around northern New South Wales, around the Rivers, Byron area
as well.
Now, tickets, if we move on. Cancelled Olympic packages. So no spectators allowed at the Olympics. Thank God the actual competitors can. But people are being refunded the tickets but without the handling fee.
Oh, well, this is just... I feel so sorry for people who had these packages. These packages generally have event tickets as well as accommodation, restaurant sightseeing tours. People bought these before the last Tokyo Olympics. So it was supposed to be, you know, early last year when they would have bought these packages. What they know so far is they're getting 80% of the event ticket value back, but not until far later this year. And we still don't know what they're going to get back in the way of accommodation, restaurants, tours they've paid for. It's been very disappointing. Now, the organisers of the tickets are blaming the Tokyo Games organisers and the Japanese government, but certainly it's a raw deal for people who hold those tickets.
Hey, can we talk about these so-called free phone apps? Everyone's being stung by these things. Australian users, apparently the biggest victims of this new breed of sort of malicious software. What do we need to watch out for? We touched on it the other day, but there's so much more to it.
Have you ever downloaded an app where it says free trial, and you think, great, and you really want to get on and try that new filter for your photos or
well,
often...
I haven't done that one, but I know what you mean.
Another example is fortune-telling apps often have this type of thing. They're one of the ones that have been pulled up the most. what they don't tell you straight off, and you have to like look into the weeds to find out, is what they're going to start charging you pretty quickly. Mm. And one example, which actually is a fortune teller app, after a week they started charging $66 a week, which adds up to around $3,500 a year. So the idea is, even if an app says to you it has a free trial, before you click on anything, make sure you know how you can cancel it and when, because sometimes that you're made to hold on to it for a year or so, and exactly how much they're going to start charging you.
And you can check,
when they
go into the subscriptions area of your phone. You go into settings. I don't know, you might know how to do it. Settings and then subscriptions, and it tells you what you've got.
You're absolutely right. That's exactly what you do. And if you don't remember those instructions, Google it, because it will tell you exactly how to do it. You can find out how to check what you're paying for.
Yeah. You don't have to. I will always be able to tell you your future for free. I won't charge you anything. Thank you, Gemma. So good to see you. Well, not since the sexual revolution in the 1960s have people felt more empowered to explore their desires in the bedroom. For years, sexologists have been encouraged... Because, well, people might be in the bedroom now doing that while trying to talk.
Oh, okay, right.
Sexologists have been encouraging us to leave shame and judgment at the doorstep and to keep an open mind.
Melbourne-based psychosexologist Chantelle Otten has a call to action for a little more action. The educator says good sexual health should always be enjoyable, pain-free and without prejudice. Now, one person who subscribes to her approach, Chantelle's boyfriend, tennis star, Paralympian and all-round nice guy, of course, Dylan Alcott. And Chantelle joins us live. Hi.
Hey.
Nice to see you. Do you feel that there's been this shift in recent generations with people feeling more confident to discuss their sexual desires, as well as the challenges? It's not a one-way street. Yeah. I mean, is that how you found as a sexologist?
I think definitely in the past 2 years I've seen quite a big change. Definitely when I came back to Australia, I used to live in Holland. About 5 years ago, we really weren't talking about sex at all. And like 2 years, even 12 months, we've really started to talk about sex a lot more. I think COVID as well. There were a lot of people who were sitting at home going, what do I do now? And how's my sex life going? Is it good? Are there things to work on? So definitely the conversation has increased. And I do know that sex toy sales, because my ambassador Love Honey monitors all these things, just went through the roof in the first lockdown for COVID. So
is that right?
Mm.
Okay, when it comes to... Well, I'm learning stuff.
Yeah,
I'm just taking it all.
Listening.
When it comes to sex and relationships, you promote open-mindedness. Is there still stuff that's taboo that you wish that was easier? I was going to say easier on the table. That's not right. To put on the table and that we should be talking about more often.
I think that still sexuality and normalizing, I guess, the various layers of sexuality is something that we definitely need to focus on. We need to move away from this Disney-oriented, you know, movie-oriented point of view that sex is about penetration and orgasm. I think we need to talk about the fact that it's messy and it's sweaty and there are people with different abilities and there are challenges that go on. And we need to talk about the fact that it is real life and individualized a lot more.
Where do we land with the sexual assault? A lot of headlines at the moment being discussed more and more, coming to light more and more, and it's worrying. Are we missing an education piece here? What needs to change? Why are we finding ourselves in this situation? Or has it always happened and now it's just getting reported more?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. I think that this is not a new situation. I think it's a devastating situation that we're still in 2021. Of course, we are missing adequate sex education that is about affirmative consent, pleasure education, and just communication and respect for the people that we are interacting with on a day-to-day basis. Mm. It's embarrassing that we're at this stage in 2021, and I'm really hoping that there will be further change quicker than we anticipate at the moment.
And does that change need to happen at the school level? Do we have to get in with the kids earlier now? And they're talking about education like this in schools now.
Mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know that affirmative consent education has just been brought in last week.
Yeah, right.
So I think that we absolutely need to be talking about this. We need to talk a lot more about, you know, also the diversity in sexuality, different genders, different sexual orientations, different representations, disability. Mm. And I think we also need to talk a lot more about pleasure, especially women's pleasure and anatomy. I have so many people coming in who don't even know how to name their own anatomy and their genitals. I think that's fundamental to what we need to talk about.
Sure. Yeah, you have a clinic with like with 20 people working with you. Wow.
Yeah.
Some lighter stuff now. Your partner, Dylan, very vocal on his podcast. And he
about his journey and sex with a disability. Mm. Does he come to you and go, hey, honey, I'm going to talk about this on the podcast today. Is this something? I imagine it's something that you talk about before he goes and shares it with the world.
No, I think. No, we have a very open household. Look, I think that Dylan is always respectful of me and our relationship, so I have no qualms with him doing whatever he feels is necessary to change the conversation around sexuality or disability. And I look, both of us are really trying to change our respective fields for the better, so yeah, go for it.
And do you feel in 2021 that those things are changing, that the boundaries around the stigmas are changing?
They're getting there.
It's getting there, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more work to do. I think the fact that our conversations, Dylan and I having these conversations, blow up so much in the media, yeah, I think that that just shows that there is still more conversation that needs to happen, for yeah, sure.
What's the one thing that you wish couples or individuals, I guess, would remember when getting intimate?
Just to have fun, not put pressure on yourself to have to perform or your partner to perform. Sex is not perfect. It's hot, it's messy, it's sweaty, accidents happen. And I think that we just need to look at the fact that it's real and that there are people interacting in this. So I like to really work a lot around communication and respectful communication in the bedroom. And I guess empathy for each other.
Have people got better at this during COVID because they've been forced to spend so much time together?
I know that I had to hire 10 more staff in the past 12 months. So I think that people are recognising that they do need to work on it.
Yeah, right.
And I think the fact that, you know, people are seeking help for it is a really positive thing.
Great. Yeah. Mm. And they're not very good at it, they've discovered.
They come for more, you know, they come for advice. Maybe that's to spice it up, or maybe because there's challenges. Not because they're not good, but maybe because they want to improve further.
Good stuff. Yeah? Thank you so much. I know, fascinating line of work.
Really?
It yeah, really is.
And thank
to
have, you.
Yeah, wow.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, today Australians will be feeling the pinch as the cost of private health insurance increases. This year's policies are set to rise by an average of 2.74%. That's an average additional cost for families of $127 a year, $59 for individuals.
Now, this is the second price hike in 6 months after the April 2020 increase was postponed till October due to the pandemic. But in good news, it is the smallest jump since 2001.
We welcome back Joe Yuchukolo from Handle My Complaint. Hi, Joe. I mean, why are premiums going up? What costs are we covering?
So the cost of delivering our health system are increasing. These are things like wages and devices. So what they say the increases are due to are more people are going to hospital, more people have chronic conditions which need to be managed, which are more costly. Even the cost of delivering mental health has gone up. So we're seeing increases in the costs, and these are reflected in our private health costs.
Okay. Now, the government rebate is also changing, which is putting pressure on prices, of course.
Yes, and this is a very well-known fact. What is happening is the government has been offering a rebate to people, and it depends on your income, but this change affects everybody who earns up to $140,000 as an individual or $280,000 as a family. And over time, the government is going to drop the rebate that it offers you to offset the cost of private health insurance. This year, it's reducing by between, you know, 0.5% and 1%, but it will continue to drop over time. So it's really important to know this.
Okay, so some funds will have bigger price hikes than others. Who decides on the final figures? I mean, is it regulated or capped at all?
Great question, Kylie. It is actually the government that approves the price increases. So each of the individual funds go to the government and ask for their price increase to be, you know, approved. So they come to the government and they say, these are what costs we need to cover. We want our policies to increase by this amount. And that goes to the health minister, and the health minister approves the increase. So they're not the same increase across the board. You mentioned that the average increase is 2.74, but it goes, one fund has got a small increase of 0.5%. And then the biggest increase we're seeing is 5.47%. Oh. So it's a big difference. Yeah. And just remember, the government has approved this price increase.
Okay. Hey, Joe, the number of people with private health insurance has rocketed in the past 6 months, thanks to the pandemic, of course. Do you expect this trend will continue?
Well, this has been interesting, Larry. So, yes, what you mentioned is more people have signed up to private health insurance during the pandemic, but 80% of the people who've joined are over 50s. And it's no coincidence that this is also the same age group that is most susceptible to COVID and COVID symptoms. So we saw 100,000 people join between July and September last year, and then 34,000 new people join between October and December last year. So I expect that this is just a little blip of more people being interested in private health insurance because they're a bit worried about what COVID would bring. But the trend over the long term has been more people leaving the private health system over time. So I think that it'll go back to that once the pandemic isn't such a big deal. And in Australia, we're really, really lucky in that we do have a really great health system. We can see that with the pandemic. If anyone presents to a health professional and says, I have COVID symptoms, they're going to get medical support, whether they're in the private or public system. And it is really important that we do make sure that everybody has access to medical help.
Any way around these additional costs? I mean, I know a couple of people who don't have private health insurance, but instead stash away the equivalent into a separate bank account and use that. I mean, that's a risk you take, I guess.
Well, that's absolutely an option. So there's a few things you can do. So a lot of people have hospital cover because it helps to offset their Medicare levy surcharge that the government applies to your tax return. So it's important to know if you hit that threshold, $90,000 as an individual or $140,000 as a family, that then the government will impose a surcharge which incentivizes you to be on the private health. So have a think about whether you're in that bracket. But that it only applies to hospital cover. That's all you need to offset that levy. So, Kylie, you might be thinking about the friends who do that for their extras cover, which is an option. Can you afford to fund the cost of any extras covers, which is dental, optical, remedial massage, physiotherapy? If you can afford to fund that out of your own wallet, then you might not need extras cover. And so there's it's definitely worthwhile shopping around and doing your research.
All right. Thanks for helping us through all of that, Jo. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, on the Why Files, we unpack the what and why of your anatomy, demystifying the most bizarre and mind-boggling bodily functions.
Hope you don't mind if we do that to you.
Today, we're looking at one of the most contagious, uncontrollable actions our body does. Now, for those playing along at home, we are talking about yawning.
Yawning. The average adult yawns about 20 times every day. So what is the purpose of a yawn? Why are they contagious? And most importantly, how many times have you yawned listening to this introduction? Right? Only a couple. That's okay. We welcome back biomedical scientist Dr. Darren Saunders. Welcome back to the show.
Morning.
Some academics think we yawn to cool the brain. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it's another one of those mysteries. That seems to be the current front-running theory. We don't actually really know for sure why we yawn.
Right.
But it seems to be, you know, we take that huge intake of breath, our jaw gets a good old stretch, and then a big exhalation, and they think that increases blood flow to our brain,
okay,
which then cools the brain a little bit, and they think that's probably the best explanation from a physiological perspective.
Okay. Right. Another theory, let's test this theory, is that yawning stretches the lungs to get obviously more oxygen into. Does that science stack up?
So that was the prevailing theory until about 25, 30 years ago, and that's really been disproven. So we used to think it was all about getting more oxygen and getting rid of carbon dioxide, and we don't think that's the case anymore. There were some pretty conclusive experiments that ruled that out.
I used to get really, really offended when Kylie would yawn when I'm talking to her, but now it happens so much, it's water off a duck's back now. But does it mean that Kylie's bored listening to me? Or is it just she's got some other things going on?
It could very well be that she's bored listening to you. And we're going to talk about contagious yawning as well.
Yeah.
It's also anxiety is a trigger for yawning. So a lot of people, a lot of athletes find that they get very anxious before they perform.
Okay.
Paratroopers, before they jump out of a plane, have been observed to do a lot more yawning than the average person. So it could be that she's anxious talking to you as well.
No, that's not possible.
What about tiredness? Like, you know, you have a big yawn, time to go to bed.
That's the obvious one.
Has tiredness got anything to do with it?
Absolutely. We definitely yawn when we're tired. And there's a few different ways of thinking about that. One is that It's a way of helping us to transition from that wakefulness to sleeping stage. And we talked a few weeks ago about how temperature is involved in regulating our sleep. Mm-hmm. So back to that brain cooling idea. There's also an idea that trying to yawn might be a way of trying to keep us alert and stop us going to sleep. So the sort of the jury's out on that one.
These things are more contagious than COVID. It's like, what if you...
I'm trying so hard not to yawn right now.
It's my voice lulling you to sleep. The chance of you yawning increases sixfold if someone else does it in front of you, right?
It is contagious. It's an echo phenomenon. So things like laughing and things we do contagiously. And we think it's related to empathy. So there are some studies out there that say that more empathetic people yawn more. And you're more likely to yawn if someone familiar to you yawns in front of you. Right. But even just thinking about it, talking about it, reading about it is enough to trigger it. It's a really strange phenomenon.
There's thousands of people in their lounge rooms yawning now. You know that,
but
don't
that
you?
Happens a lot watching the morning show. Like, people do that all the time.
Well, I was...
Don't say that. Can we stop it? Because have you ever tried to stop a yawn? It's very ugly.
Oh, yeah. Here's a brutal piece of science. There was one study where they asked people to try to stop yawning. Mm-hmm. In fact, it made them yawn more. It actually increased the urge to yawn when you ask people to try and stop doing it.
Don't tell me what to do.
Exactly. How have we been doing this for so many millions of years and scientists haven't got on top of this yet? How can it be so difficult?
It's one of those things. And it is deeply seated in evolution. So, you know, lots of different animals do it. And it seems to occur in the brainstem, which is the really, really primitive part of our brains.
Look, we found a turtle yawning.
Deep evolutionary.
Oh, that was me.
And even dogs. A dog will yawn if it sees its owner yawn, and it's more likely to do it to a familiar face.
So animals will do it if their owner does it?
Yeah. So dogs will yawn in response to their human owner yawning.
See, but that's back to the empathy thing, isn't it? The dogs are very empathetic. I mean, they can sniff out cancer, so the myth goes. So
yeah, the empathy thing's controversial. There's some evidence for it, there's some evidence against it. So people with psychopathic traits don't tend to yawn very often. And some mental illnesses that are related to empathy and human connection, people with those illnesses don't tend to yawn as much either.
So if we have, hypothetically, let's just round it up, let's just say we have a million people watching us now.
Yep.
How many of those would have yawned just through this?
Most of them, I would think. Which is great for television, isn't it?
So we have some very oxygenated... very oxygenated... Yeah, your career on this show is cut real short.
All right, Darren, lovely to talk to you. Thank you. What a mystery.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those great mysteries.
Well, did we solve it? Not really.
We got a little bit of evidence.
To cool the brain.
Yeah, I think we unpacked a lot of our viewers' anatomy. During that.
I hope you're okay with that.
No, they're fine. We have a very good relationship
Saunders
with our viewers.
Unpacking the Y files for us this morning. Well, it's safe to say that no one would have predicted the changes we've experienced over this last year, how we work, how we travel, or don't travel, socialise, all of it has been flipped on its head in the most unexpected way, which leaves us wondering what will the world look like in another 12 months and beyond that?
So many questions today. We're crystal balling into the future, from the jobs our kids will land and the hybrid offices they'll work in, to our houses and the technology we'll be using. It's time to do some post-pandemic predicting.
For more, we welcome Ashley Fell from McCrindle Research. Hello, Ashley.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, let's start with school leavers. Our kids are predicted to have 18 jobs across 6 careers during their working life.
Yeah, that's right. I know it sounds like a lot, and it is. And we project that based on the average tenure of someone staying in one job for 2 years and 9 months. That's the average across all generations.
Is that all it is?
That's right.
Two years and 9 months.
So we extrapolate that out over the lifetime of a school leaver today. As I mentioned, noting they'll work later into their life because they're going to live longer. So it is a phenomenal amount of jobs and careers.
The workplaces they enter are going to look really different too. You're saying that well-being will be a strong focus in the future, and loneliness will become a real issue for employees working remotely if we're looking that way.
Yeah, that's right. So this work from home era that we all now find ourselves in, there were so many benefits, and our research showed that, you know, the lack of commute time, the money savings, but the biggest challenge for many Australians who worked from home was actually the social isolation. And our research showed many people said 2020 was just such a tough year, so we predict that well-being is really going to need to be a key focus of leaders, especially for the emerging generations who are a lot more anxious as a result of COVID because they'd never lived through anything like this before.
So if we look at people working from home, then things get a little crowded because everyone's working from home, you've got multiple generations living under the one roof.
Yeah, that's right. So we already had a little bit of that prior to the pandemic, and then you've got young families coming back to live at home with mum and dad, particularly younger generations impacted by sectors like hospitality and tourism. So they come back at home, and that's why they often labelled a generation of kippers, if you've heard of that. Kids in parents' pockets eroding retirement
savings. So they're living at home a bit later and drawing on the bank of mum and dad a little bit more. So multiple generations.
That's a lot to remember. Sponges is an easier one than that. What are the big lifestyle trends that you're tipping for 2021?
Yeah, so we're predicting that a lot of people will actually leave the capital cities because we can work remotely, we can work from home, make that sea change or tree change. So those lifestyle factors that some of the rural areas were real barriers for people living there because there was a lack of employability, but now work from home has just opened that right up. The other thing we're seeing is a real resilience among Australians as a result of the pandemic, and also a greater authenticity among us as we looked into the homes of our colleagues and clients, and you saw their dogs and kids coming in. We sort of got a bigger snapshot of someone. So I think that's a real positive to come out of what was for many a really challenging year last year.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift gears. Population trends. We're looking at the lowest birth rates on record at the moment.
That's right. So currently the total fertility rate for an Australian woman is 1.6, and that's the lowest it's been for a very long time.
1.6 children.
Per woman, and that's below the replacement rate for a couple of two children. And we know that that often happens in times of uncertainty, global economic uncertainty, which is what we're in at the moment. And so it'll be interesting. I mean, it's almost 20 years since we saw the baby bonus in Australia. So what's going to happen in terms of how we encourage or incentivise women to have more kids?
Sure.
Okay. Now, speaking of population booms and busts, we have to have a look at our littlest generation and talk baby names. And you're seeing an interesting trend of nicknames stepping up. Stepping up and becoming the proper name.
That's right. So these millennial parents who are parenting Generation Alpha, these young kids of today, there's some real key trends we're seeing in our analysis of names like Billy instead of William and Archie instead of Archer, and all these sort of little iterations becoming the normal name. So, yeah, some real shifts happening among millennials who are naming their kids.
I think we had some graphics there of some of those names. There we go. With Charlotte, Olivia, they're the top names.
Top names in Australia.
Okay, Ash, you don't mind if I call you Ash?
I don't.
Thanks, Ash. Good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Former Olympian Yana Pittman has overcome many hurdles in her life, but when it came to the outdoor arena, nothing could stand in her way.
It's the same fighting spirit that the superstar has implemented in her new career, raising awareness and tackling the stigma of cervical cancer, a cause Yana is deeply passionate about, not only as a doctor, that's what she is now too, but also as a patient. Dr. Yana Pittman joins us. Hello.
Hello, hello. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We love talking to you. We talk about superwoman. You really are a bit of a superwoman.
No. I just haven't got much sleep happening at the moment. So
you have, last time we spoke to you, you've got four children now. Yes. They range in age from 14 down to 5 months.
That's right.
How is life in your household?
Eclectic and busy and difficult to maintain lots of goals at this point, but I just love having a big family. So it was one of my goals as a child to have 5 kids. Hint, hint, there's only 4 there.
No, here we go.
Not yet. But yeah, I've just always wanted to have a lovely balance of children and work and medicine and sport. So I just feel very lucky that I've got these beautiful little people around me.
Is everyone helping out? Is
the groom
helping
one.
Out? The big one.
He hasn't got a choice, does he? The 14-year-old definitely rings in there with the kids and puts them to sleep a couple of times at night, which is really lovely. I've got a lovely little network of kids at home. I know, isn't he gorgeous?
Who's that there? What are they
That's little Charlie, the little one, and Jemima. So they're the two youngest.
Oh.
Yeah, my little blessings.
Just adorable.
Yeah, and our little puppy.
Now, what brings you to this couch today? It's probably the only time you get to sit down. So you've probably come in for a bit of a sit down.
Have a relax.
But you're also the ambassador for the Australian Cervical Cancer Foundation.
That's right.
Now, this is important to you. You are a doctor now because upon top of all those other things, you're a doctor. But now you find yourself as a patient.
That's correct. So cervical cancer for me has been a bit of an interesting relationship for the last few years. And I've been an amazing ambassador for this organisation, Australian Cervical Cancer Foundation, for probably, about 5 years now. When at the beginning of my medical school career, I actually found out I had a dysplasia myself. So that's not quite cancer, but it's just beforehand when there's dysplastic cells. And it was because I was probably 10 years out of date with my screening, so I was a little bit nervous then. Mm. And unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks, I had another account. So postpartum, you're supposed to go 6 weeks, have a checkup. They did another pap smear, or what we call now is a cervical screening test. And unfortunately, it was positive again. So I guess it's good because I want to be a gynecologist down the track as a doctor, but it was also an example for me that we really need to get this message back out there. There is a little bit of stigma around cervical cancer. I think women aren't quite prepared to come out and talk about it, but 4 out of 5 of us are going to have a positive HPV in some stage in their life, and that's the main cause, the human papillomavirus of cervical cancer.
And this will shock and frighten a lot of people to hear it, that you had no symptoms on this.
Nothing.
Right?
Nothing at all.
So is that common?
It can be very common. So we can literally, and that's why our screening program is so important. You know, in Australia, Australia, we only have women about 1 in 50 which will actually have cervical cancer in their lifetime compared to other underdeveloped nations, which are down in 1 in 12. So our program has to get the message out there that even if you have no symptoms, yes, it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to have a speculum inserted into their vagina, let's be honest, but it could literally save your life. So I feel very grateful that I'm, one, the ambassador and trying to raise awareness and funds for the ACCF, but also that I am the patient so that when I am a future gynaecologist, I can actually see what that woman feels like coming into my office, laying down there and, you know, exposing herself to have that, to have that exam. So
and COVID hasn't helped, and lockdowns haven't helped because people just aren't keeping up to date, are they?
Yeah, so that's a big message. We missed a lot of our screening last year, of course, because we didn't want to go out in that environment. But if you're behind in your screening, you could be putting yourself at risk. So we need to really make sure that message is out there for women.
Okay. Hey, can we flash back to the sports stuff? We love this stuff. Fellow Olympian
Tamsin Lewis.
Yeah, recently put this pic of your Commonwealth Games winning relay team.
It was lovely, that picture.
Can you believe it? 2002. Almost two decades later. Do you guys all keep in touch?
Yeah, and I actually reposted this picture because it's just such a lovely example of the team. There's Kathy Freeman there and Lauren Hewitt, Tamsin Lewis and myself. It was a bit of a dream team back in the day.
Yeah.
It was a very huge honour to be running with those girls. And yeah, we definitely keep in contact. It's a very, you know, a small sport. There's not a lot of people at the top end in athletics in Australia. Sure. So you definitely need to band together with your friends.
Tokyo Olympics, Yana, 113 days. Gee, it's been disrupted.
Yeah,
it's been awful for the athletes.
Positive and negative actually there, because we've had actually a few extra athletes make the qualification time. So given that little bit bigger window to actually qualify means our team may be a little bit stronger than we're anticipating.
Oh, see, look, you are a glass half full girl, actually. Yeah. Looking for the positives in it. Wait, do you get a little bit itchy and scratchy around this time, like you're wanting to
like jump a hurdle?
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, I miss running. I love my new career as a doctor. It's such a blessing, but, you know, you can't not miss the adrenaline and the associated endorphins that come with, actually, bobsled's even more fun than athletics, in all truth. But
Do you still run at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So
just
for mental health. Yeah. So just to get out there and get that good, happy energy going through your body is really important.
Does anyone ever look at you as you overtake them on the footpath?
I think
the
size puts people off because I'm quite a large woman, 85 kilos, all of it.
Do people look at you funny when you're running down the street and you start jumping over fences?
I don't do that. I'm not that stupid.
So good to see you. Thanks
you
for coming in. Always a
Thanks,
treat.
Jan. Always great to see
all right.
you.
Thanks for listening to the Morning Show podcast. Be sure to subscribe and follow. And for more info on these stories, just head to themorningshow.com.au. And I'll catch you again weekday mornings right after sunrise on Channel 7. Bye for now.
Thank you.